listening to People Powered Radio, proudly supported by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. cbf.com.au.
You're listening to Lawyers Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Community Connections on Yarra Valley FM 99.1, the voice of the valley. And being the second Wednesday of the month, we have with us the Legal Hour, and it's my pleasure to introduce, first of all, Grant Hutchison, who's the managing partner of Hutchison Legal, and he's also brought along Bridget with him as well. Welcome.
Thank you.
G'day. It's always good to be here.
No, it's good to have you here too, Grant. Grant, we sent you off last time. We had a question from a listener, and we've got one or two today to send you away with. But it was about what the judge has to look at. What the parole board has to look at before they do give parole, and what reasons do they knock back parole?
Well, I personally know a couple of members of the parole board, and it's obviously they were appointed in the past, but I really think the best person to answer this is Bridget. So
over to you, Bridget. What do they have to think about?
I will just give some examples if that helps.
Yep.
The parole board will look at the sentence imposed by the court, including any comments by the court about parole and rehabilitation, and any psychiatric or psychological reports available to the court when you imposed the sentence, and any victim impact statements provided to the sentencing court, the nature and circumstances of the offence for which the prisoner is serving a sentence, and also the prisoner's criminal history, including performance on past parole orders and community-based orders.
Right, you just said that they look at the psychiatric reports and all that. Do they also call for, like, if a person was, say, 10, 15 years ago sentenced and they got a minimum of, say, 12 years, would they be likely to call for another report?
More recent, the better. So they usually look at the most recent report prepared by the psychiatrist or psychologist to see, you know, the status of the person's mental status, yeah.
All right, so what reason would they give to knock back parole? Say the judge, well, say they gave them 15 years, minimum of 12, comes up to 12 years. What are they going to take into, apart from the reports and the sentencing, is there anything on their current that they need to look at? You know, how they've been, what sort of prison they've been, or anything like that?
The board will generally consider all relevant information, and take them into account when making a decision to grant a parole or, you know, to not granted that parole, so they will look at all the information available to them.
Right, so if we'll stick with this example that they've been given 15 years with a minimum of 10, supposing the 10 years come up and the parole board say no, does the prisoner then get another chance between the 15, or is it automatically say, well, no, if you can't get parole at the 10, you get it at 15?
So it is a judge role to set a parole period. It's not actually the board's role to actually look into and set a sentence about an parole period. It's actually the judge to set a non-parole period, and yet the non-parole period is basically the minimum time that the offender needs to serve in the prison. So it is actually not the board's role to look into this. The board's role is actually to consider the risk of the prisoner's transition back into the community.
Fair enough. All right, we'll take a quick break and we'll come back with more on Community Connections.
You're listening to Lawyers Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
Welcome back to Community Tunes. Community Connections.
That's coming up next.
Yeah, Choice Tunes is coming up at 2 o'clock. And we've got a terrific guest coming in. Brilliant. We just need a supplementary question. We've talked about the parole, and I used Bridget the example that a judge sends someone to 15 years, gives them a non-parole period of 10. They go before the parole board. The parole board say no. Do they? Can they? How long before they can have another crack at it? Can they, or do they have to go and serve the full 15 years?
Well, I don't know how long they have to wait, but I know they have to wait a period, but they can try again. They don't have to wait. Just think of it this way, and we've all seen the Shawshank Redemption and, you know, the fellow coming up before the parole board. It's not exactly the same here, but our parole boards are pretty tough. But all I'd say is, part of the keeping control of people in jail is the idea that if you behave yourself, if you show you're reformed, if you go through certain aspects, then that gives them an incentive to behave rather than simply wait their term. Does that make sense? So
yep.
there was that Chopper Reed fellow. It was getting near the end of his time, and they said to him, they were almost wanting to give him parole because with parole they can then set conditions around the parole that control you beyond the term of your imprisonment.
So if you serve the 15 years, then there's no control.
Well, let's just say there's not the parole board conditions that control you, and there is the law still that controls you. And he said, no, I'll wait it out. I'll go with when I've done my time. And,
oh, right.
And so he was effectively able to go. So most people would take it, but then allows the authorities to have a level of control beyond that time.
There was a case in the paper, you probably saw it a week or so ago, where a guy's just been resentenced, I think, for murder. I'm not sure.
Right.
But he'd been in jail so long, he couldn't cope being outside, and he actually committed another serious crime, which I think it might have been murder, but the whole reason behind it was to get himself back into prison.
Yeah, I think murder's a bit extreme, but you can get back in jail with a lot less than that. You can just you can breach your bail conditions, and he probably wanted a decent stint. I'm told that, I've spoken to people in various aspects or perspectives on this, and apparently Victorian prisons are nicer than New South Wales prisons. So if somebody wants to spend time in jail, they're not going to commit another offence in New South Wales. They'll come south of the border and commit an offence. So the advantage of having better prisons down here. But I'd say I don't think you or I would like it.
No, I wouldn't do it. Grant, you wanted to talk about the jab, no jab, rule. Is it a law or is it a rule?
It's a directive that has legal sanctions and consequences that flow. Remember, a few years ago, Alan, you might recall when there was the health officer was entitled to pass directives to do with HIV/AIDS and also VD. You know, but people can't knowingly transmit disease.
Yep.
The right to choose to have or to not have a jab carries with it consequences, and people need look. I say it this way. People need to be prepared to accept the consequences of their choice.
Greg,
last point. But the right to not be vaccinated does not give you the right to infect other people.
Right.
So just because I'm saying I'm not, so the health officer can put directives around to stop the spread of disease, and so. So I can see you're excited. Your pen's
it's
rare to see Alan excited. He's excited now. And so does that gives you the what I'd say is the context or some framework for some people's belief. Others believe there should be no freedom until everything is taken care of. I think that's pretty. We were once facing an elimination strategy.
Yep.
Now that strategy, the idea of the aim of elimination, that's gone.
Yep.
It's more in terms of trying to reduce the burden on our hospital systems. And please, I'm not saying I'm lining up with this government, but all I'm saying, and I don't think this is a place to get political, but all we are saying is we're in Victoria, and as such, we need to abide by the laws of Victoria. But some people are doing some pretty drastic things to avoid this 15th of October deadline.
So two things I want to ask. Does the Chief Health Officer overrule the Discrimination Act? And secondly, when the state of emergency ends, therefore, I'm not saying that this is what happens. These orders are coming in under the state of emergency. When the state of emergency disappears, we'll say in December or whenever it might be, does that then mean that this order or any order that he's brought out just go out the door?
Good question. I'd need to look more carefully at it, but normally you would think that logically you couldn't pass a directive during a state of emergency based on state of emergency powers that then extends for the next 10 or 15 years. That would be absurd.
Yep.
Because so is there a lag period? I think common sense would dictate that powers that come as a consequence of a state of emergency would not survive or not carry on beyond. But let me check that, but I'm... Just because it's logical doesn't mean it's the case. So that's part of your question. I think the other part of your question was, remind me.
Does it override the Discrimination Act? Because you can't discriminate against anybody on any basis.
That's not me, but you should get milk on the way home, I think.
All right, we'll take a quick break and we'll be back with more.
You're listening to Lawyers Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
And just a quick mention, if you've got any aspect of the law, as I often say, we can't talk about cases, but if you want to know some aspect of the law, you've got about 20 minutes to give a ring on 59 615 99 59 615 99, 615 99, and we'll put them to Grant and Bridget and see how we go. I'm sure we'll get an answer.
What was that number again, Alan?
59 615 99 99.
You'd say it with a sense of rhythm. You could almost sing that, I think.
I don't think you wouldn't want to hear me sing. In fact, I sound a bit croaky in the voice today too.
It sounded good.
Now, I go into this with a bit of intrepidation.
Before we do, the discrimination, you want to know whether the...
Yeah.
So just on basic principles.
Yep.
Every parliament is sovereign, and as such, a later act of... So if there's an inconsistency between two pieces of legislation, the later legislation overrides the earlier legislation unless it's expressed otherwise.
Yeah.
So if there... I don't believe there's an inconsistency. I think what you're asking is whether the application of the Discrimination Act would prevent certain directives. Because can you override? Normally constitutional things always override, because the Constitution can only be changed in a different way.
Yep.
And there's the Victorian Constitution and the Australian Constitution, so two totally different documents. In this area, I would say, at the end of the day, could somebody say, you're not allowed to discriminate against me on the basis of whether I've been jabbed or no jabbed? I think the Act specifically sets out the grounds on which you cannot discriminate in relation to gender, in relation to ethnic background and all sorts. I doubt that there is a ground. I don't believe last time I looked that there is a ground on whether you're jabbed or non-jabbed. So the Act specifically delineates what you can and can't discriminate, upon which you can discriminate. Look, I'm happy to look at it again, but I can't recall, so just responding in the moment. And really, remember, you can... Discrimination, let's get the word right. Discrimination is really the differentiation between one from another. The discrimination is a dirty word in our current political landscape. But to discriminate between whether I choose that banana or that banana, because you're choosing the green bananas or the lady finger bananas, that's a sense of choice. To differentiate between the two is not necessarily a bad thing. It's when you treat people differently because of things they cannot change about themselves, and that is wrong.
Right.
So does that make sense?
So, yeah, that makes sense. So if you and I went for a job... pardon me. If you and I went for a job... And you're jabbed and I'm not, or vice versa. We're not going to get in. I don't want to get into that sort of discussion. I couldn't then say, if you got the job because you'd been jabbed and I didn't, I couldn't turn around. If the boss said to me, have you been jabbed? And I said no, then I couldn't go back and say, well, you discriminated. You gave the job to Grant because he was vaxxed and I wasn't.
I'd put it a slightly different way. Could you effectively say, I refuse to answer on the grounds that you're asking about medical treatment that I've received and that is not, you shouldn't be under the privacy law. Show me how that you can. So if you refuse to answer the question, could somebody then discriminate about information that they cannot get under the Privacy Act? It just gets layer upon layer of possible misunderstanding or possible... This is why lawyers love it. they can make so much money out of this. I remember a QC I was sitting with and he said to me, Grant, these amendments, the government says they're simplifying it. He said, all it means is more money for lawyers because it's going to be more interpretation required. And
I guess, in fairness, this is going to be tried in the courts, isn't it? There's going to be someone who's going to take this to court.
Yes, there's a crowd up in New South Wales that seems to represent, people believe are representing them in Victoria. I don't know whether they actually are. I believe they've only got Supreme Court proceedings in New South Wales. So unless they've issued something since late September that I haven't heard about. But yes, there was a teacher who is running something down here. And look, there's all sorts of cases. The courts are open for people to say, I have a grievance or I have this issue that I want determined. And as long as they have what's called standing, in other words, the relevance to themselves normally, and then they can take that to the court and the court should adjudicate and say, yes, this is the position we take on it. So I think people are waiting to see. Obviously, there's been a recent decision, and there was a decision a few months ago from the High Court in relation to matters. But all I would say is, I'm not saying it's a lawyer's picnic, but it's a jolly close.
It's good to
and what you want to do is, what would be fantastic is if there could be clarity around this so that the people know before the 15th, will the court give it urgency? Or that type of urgency, that's normally when you go off to the practice court and seek to get some type of injunctive relief. But normally the courts let governments govern and don't try to... But when courts act in what's called ultra vires, beyond their power, then the courts have to say, hey... And that's really where courts come to the fore in terms of under our Westminster system of the separation of the courts from the parliament, the judiciary, and also the executive, the differentiation between powers, and that's really where it's important that the judges can say, "Hey, that's just not on. You have so much power, but you don't have unlimited power."
Right. Now, the other one that you wanted to talk about, I'm a bit wary about this.
Oh, and I've forgotten. What do I want to talk about?
You want about this doctor who used his own sperm for how many dozens of children?
I think, Bridget, did you want to talk about
that? She doesn't want to touch it.
Okay. Well, you recall back in July, there was a case, and please, we're basing this on newspaper reports, so we're not defaming anybody, but as we understand it in Canada, a doctor involved in a fertility clinic took it upon himself to allow his own sperm to be used instead of other sperm that was available. And the thought is that he may have 237 children now. That'd be pretty tough to try and support 237. Just think how many grandchildren and great-grandchildren you might end up with. But it was done without consent, done without knowledge. Now, a doctor may flatter himself and think, I'm doing everybody a favour. Oh. But that's not his or her prerogative. Oh, I suppose no. It's his prerogative. Yeah. But doctors can be male or female. But it's not the doctor's choice. And if people have come for fertility treatment or treatment from a fertility, it's not for the doctor to impose their own way.
How would that go as far as inheritance? So the doctor dies down the track. Now he's got these 235 children apart from his own. Would they have a claim on his will? Because they would be stepchildren or something, wouldn't they? Well, they'd be children.
Yes, I believe there was, in Victoria, there was legislation about this because often university students would go along and give sperm donations and get a free lunch or $20 or whatever it was. And they didn't want the thought that one day they'll be chased down. So there was meant to be a level of anonymity as to who the person was, but also no claims that could effectively be made. I'm not sure of whether that's developed, because quite often what's put in place as safeguards, that was done with the thought at the time of the male participant. But later on, it wasn't done with the thought of protecting the children. Children need, so they need to be able to get, in that context, they'd get declassified or redacted names, but enough details so they could help with their own medical treatment.
Because I think the anonymity's been taken away, hasn't it?
I think you're right. So, and then it's, you know, just so somebody want a relationship with children that they didn't know they were having? Do they not want to? Did the children want, could the parent pursue and want to seek it? Relationship with children, if later on this person who had donated later couldn't produce, was in an infertile position or not able to, not in a position to have children, do they want to chase these things down? I think the, as I say, the protection was around the donor rather than the children. Let's I was about to say produce, and that sounds so wrong.
It's not right.
No, the children, the offspring as a result. So how do we do this? So it's a balancing act and getting it right. It was only when children grew up that then the courts started to understand, or the government started to understand, we need to take their thoughts and their emotions.
Particularly if there's an illness too, isn't it?
Well, I think the medical material could have been provided without the name, but now they want the name, or some do, some don't. Mm. Some say, well, why do I want to have a relationship with the guy that just donated sperm? You know, who gives a whatever. So does that make sense?
Certainly does. We've just got a quick break and we'll be back with
Fantastic.
More.
You're listening to Lawyers Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
Welcome back to Community Connections. And I must mention that 1 o'clock, after 1 o'clock news, I've got another interview with Young at Heart, which is a new group, and they're going to tell us all about their festival that's coming up. And then at 2 o'clock or 3 o'clock, we've got Choice Tunes. So we've got a terrific guest, and we'll have Grant in about 4 weeks today, I think, and he's going to do his Choice Tunes. Bridget, they tell me you know a bit about debt collecting. So I don't like to say this, but I owe someone $100,000 that I can't pay. So what happens then?
Well, then that person can initiate court proceedings against you. So usually,
in which court?
It really depends on the quantum. Like, let's say the quantum is like less than $100,000, it will be at the magistrate court. Less than or equal to $100,000, you'll be at the magistrate court. If it's more than $100,000, then the person can take you to county court or supreme court. But usually people will take you to county court, because supreme court is more for more complicated cases and matters.
Right. So, obviously, you're owed the $100,000 from me, mm-hmm. So it doesn't just straight away go to court, does it?
No. So usually people give you like a final warning first before initiating any court proceedings, and we call it letter of demand. Usually you ask a lawyer, or you can personally draft it yourself, but it's better to ask a lawyer to prepare one for you, and then you send it to the borrower and say, look, I give you 14 days and please pay back the money. If you don't, I will take you to court.
Do you only give the one notice, or and how long after you think the debt's not going to be? Do you have to have 3 or 4 letters, or just the one letter? Or?
Usually I recommend clients to just do one letter, but with 14 days period. So 14 days is a reasonable amount of time for that person to repay you the money. Right. Usually if someone is willing to repay the money, they will, you know, propose to do it by instalment, or, you know, do it instantly.
Yep. All right. So, pardon me. if it's $100,000, obviously you're going to have written payment, written contract before you take out or borrow this $100,000. Supposing it's something like $5,000, I just loaned it to a friend of mine. They scribble on a bit of paper, I owe you $5,000 or whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. Is that enough to get it into court, or do you need more proof? You know, do you need something a bit more solid as a if you're going to loan money, I guess?
Well, it's always good to get something solid, like a proper written contract. But usually when people lend money or borrow money, they don't have a proper contract in place.
Yep.
So in order to do that, we need to gather circumstantial evidence, like what did that person actually say to you when he loaned you the money or when he borrowed the money from you.
Yep.
So we need to gather those evidence and actually put it in the claim itself and then file with the court. So usually people, if that person has drafted, let's say, a receipt, we can rely on it as part of our claim as well.
All right. So if you're loaning people money, I mean, obviously the more signed down you can get, the better for it is.
That's right.
Because the other issue, and how do you get around this? So I borrow $5,000 from you or from Grant, and we're good buddies, so we just say, well, that's all right. Mm-hmm. And then you send me a letter of demand, and I say, oh, no, you gave me that $5,000. How do you get a case like that into court? Because you haven't got much to go on, have you?
Well, we usually, if that's the case, we usually rely on verbal agreement. So agreement can be done verbally, but it's good to have something written in place. So that's why I always recommend clients to do a proper contract when they loan money to other people.
Because quite often with smaller amounts, they just loan it to friends and then,
yes,
and
that's
then
right.
They lose their money and lose the friendship.
Exactly. Well, people have like a chance to do mediation before going to trial. So there are a few steps before you actually go to a hearing itself, like the final hearing. Oh. So usually when you initiate claim at, let's say, at the magistrate court, the other side has 21 days to respond to your claim.
Oh.
And then after that, you go to mediation and you try to resolve the matters.
So it goes to mediation before it gets to court.
That's right, because the court would like you to have a chance to resolve it between yourself before going to the court.
Terrific. All right, we'll just take one quick break and we'll be back with more.
Thank you.
You're listening to Lawyers Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
Welcome back to Community Connections on Yarra Valley FM 99.1, the voice of the valley. It's only 6 minutes to go to 1 o'clock. Grant, it goes really fast when we
have... It does with you, Ellen. You're always full of bright ideas.
Be careful what you say.
I'm being very positive today, and having Bridget here today was a real treat. So thanks for coming, Bridget.
No worries.
Right, you probably told us you had to go. righto. We always send you away with a question, so we're going to ask you. This one's fairly easy, and it's regarding COVID fines. And I don't want to get into this stuff of whether they're right or whether they're wrong and all that, but we want a legal definition. Somebody asked the question, can the police only issue a COVID fine if they see the offence being committed? So that if I've got a neighbour down the road who's all of a sudden got 20 cars out the front, and I decide I'm going to ring and dob you in, and the police have got other things on that afternoon, they don't get there till 3 hours later and all the cars are gone, can they still issue a fine, or does it have to be that they saw it? Because otherwise, I guess then it becomes a crossroads. So if you could come up with that for next time,
yep.
I'd really like to know.
That's a good question.
Grant, we've still got a few more minutes to go.
Talk about anything.
What would you like to talk about?
Well, if it's coincidentally happened to be my wife's birthday today, I'd be wanting to say very happy birthday to Wendy. But, of course, I wouldn't. If she had said not to say anything, I wouldn't say anything. So,
man, you fly by the seat of your pants.
And I'm not going to mention, I still remember the first time I met Wendy, But I'm not going to mention the first Valentine's Day we had together.
No, you're not.
No.
Or I'll turn you off. And she lived, if I remember rightly, she lived in Queensland, didn't she?
She did, but I met her on a beach down on the peninsula at Rye.
Did you?
No, West Rosebud we met. And I still know the spot. I can take the children to the spot. This is where I first laid eyes on your mother.
That's terrific. So how did you pick her up at the beach?
Well, now, this is getting close to Valentine's Day type of thing. There was a thing called blooping. Now, you may not know what blooping is, but I can't tell you because it's only allowed to be demonstrated and you need water and night time. And anyway, I took her blooping and...
But you met her on the foreshore.
I met her on the foreshore, and we knew that something was, you know, we went to the Rye Carnival, and it was New Year's Eve, and we'd both driven in different cars, her with a group of girls and myself with a group of guys, and I thought I could fit in with the girls, but then found out later that as I went to the car that, no, there wouldn't be room for you, and the guys had left, and so I found myself walking back from Rye back, and that was New Year's Eve, and that was when it was pretty wild down on the peninsula.
No, it was really wild. Yeah.
The cars used to go up and down, and but I got invited in for quite a few drinks that night as I made my way back from Rye, and the look on her face that she was so concerned when I got back told me everything. So, yes, Wendy was... anyway, let's not give her a name because I don't want to embarrass her. Well, it could be a pseudonym.
I bet it's not.
I bet it's not too.
But so she was obviously down from Queensland on holidays.
She was down, yeah, with a friend called Jeanette. And yep. Jeanette and I had only gone out the once, and that was, you know, we'd worked out that was probably...
That was
about the extent of it. go on.
So whereabouts were you, staying at a house down there? Or?
No, down on the foreshore.
Yep.
And, yeah, we just said, so it was great to meet. You know how people can camp along the foreshore?
Yep.
Well, there was actually a group of us that were down there, and it was tremendous. So we had a great time, and I think our children are all grateful that we met, otherwise they wouldn't exist.
They wouldn't exist. And I've said that to my kids a few times too. No, that's terrific. And so she came down before you were married, or like did she come down to work before? Or
yeah,
did
she actually, she got a job with the, so I proposed by telephone of all things. How terribly unromantic, but I was kneeling.
But if she's in Queensland, what can you do?
At least that's what I can say. And so she came down and lived in Swan Hill, and she worked for the education department as a speech pathologist up initially at Swan Hill and then at Lilydale. So she moved in and she was a speech pathologist there for quite some time. Now she's at another school that I won't mention, but yep, with the education department. And she's a brilliant speech pathologist. So
that's terrific. And you'd get sick of travelling up to Queensland to see her all the time too, wouldn't you?
Well, her mother used to intercept my letters and read them. I didn't realise at the time, but look, there was nothing in them. But anyway.
Grant, unfortunately the time's coming quite to an end. We're just about to go to the 1 o'clock news.